Welcome to KUOW's The Record, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. We are on Twitter at KUOW. You know, you don't have to fall in love, okay? Love is not a hole that you fall into. Love doesn't have to mean swooning with helplessness, and you don't have to be crazy in love. These are just metaphors that our culture has embedded into your brain. In a few minutes, you'll meet a guest who demanded more than that. She wouldn't just accept that. She went to find out what love really is, biologically, functionally, and the author of How to Fall in Love with Anyone is going to be here in about 15 minutes. And we're going to take your calls, too. So think about it. Did your personal love story follow our cultural story of what love is? Or did your love story turn the culture on its head? Get ready to call in. Now, my first guest this hour is in love. You're in love with your city, right?
I love Seattle.
Washington State Senator Bob Hasegawa. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
You're running to be the mayor of the city you love.
I'm doing that.
Primary ballots are due August 1st. We're getting to know all the leading candidates on KUOW, so we want to find out what your love of Seattle means to you, the relationship you want to have with this city. First of all, what do you want us to know about you personally? Some of us know you and some don't.
Well, I love Seattle because I'm a lifelong resident here, third generation, actually, Seattleite, love the Pacific Northwest, grew up enjoying the great outdoors. I was in Boy Scout Troop 53, which actually was the oldest certified Boy Scout troop in our area for the longest time.
Mm-hmm.
But our scout leaders...
What kind of scout were you in Troop 53?
A good scout.
Uh-huh.
I won't go beyond that.
Uh-huh.
Our scout leaders, though, were the former 442nd soldiers who came back after World War II, and they were taskmasters, believe me. But it was the best life lessons I could have had, you know, from some of the most honorable people that I've had the pleasure of knowing. So it's that framed me.
What life lesson did you learn?
Oh, honor, hard work, all of those, the work ethics that are involved with success, about standing solid for your principles, that's everything that they stood for.
Mm-hmm.
They enlisted to prove that Japanese Americans were loyal citizens and didn't deserve to be locked up in concentration camps, and to prove that the Constitution needs to be defended. That's why I am who I am, is because I've learned that lesson, that we have to be constantly vigilant to protect our civil rights and liberties.
Are you finding your vigilance rising this last several months?
Well, it's always been on high alert, but yes, the last several months have been extremely condition red. You know, we're getting attacked on so many different fronts against our civil rights and personal liberties. And a lot of people wonder why. They question whether I'm a real Democrat in regard to a lot of my libertarian side, but, you know, that's who I am. That's what my community raised me to be. And so that's why I've sponsored bills in the legislature, for instance, to prevent state and local law enforcement from enforcing Trump's anti-Muslim.
Right. That's a libertarian issue for you.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. And as well as, for instance, I sponsored a bill in the Patriot Act that was proposed years back, actually. There was a provision in that act that allowed the president to indefinitely detain anybody for any reason without due process. So I had a bill to not allow state and local law enforcement to enforce that presidential order as well.
Well, let's talk about some of the issues for someone who wants to be the mayor of this city. We asked KUOW listeners to tell us what Seattle needs most, and the top three answers were cost of housing. There were others, but I am asking all the candidates, what would you do about the cost of housing that Mayor Murray isn't doing, if anything? Or would you stay the course?
No, I definitely would not stay the course. You know, cost of housing is affected by two major things right now, in my opinion. Number one is obviously the property values increases, but I'll get to that in a second. One of the things that Seattle has a problem of doing is trying to move towards a more progressive tax system. And so when we, as Seattleites, are so good-hearted and want to do the right things, but we keep going back to the same regressive tax sources like property tax and sales tax to fund those good things, that's making it cost prohibitive for seniors, those on fixed incomes, low and middle income folk to stay in Seattle. The other thing is that because of the increasing property values themselves, which also raises the property taxes, that exists because of the huge gap between the number of people that want to live in Seattle and the available housing units we actually have for those people to live in. So that imbalance in the supply and demand is shooting the property values through the roof. The current system that is in place is sort of, to me, it's a non-starter, because as we see how it's being implemented, this HALA program with the MHA set-asides on affordable housing for development, it's not going to get anywhere near producing the amount of housing we need to offset that imbalance in the supply and demand.
Basically, this is requiring developers to set aside affordable units or kick in some money
Correct.
To help pay for that.
Correct.
Not enough.
Not enough. And in fact, it's the wrong strategy, because it's like asking developers to do the right thing. Some developers might do the right thing and set aside plenty of affordable housing, at least enough to house the people that they've displaced through their development process. But developers are in there to make money, and we shouldn't expect them to do otherwise. Maybe that's some of my union negotiating background is, you know, we expect business to negotiate for business, just as we expect workers and the unions that represent them to negotiate on their behalf, and then you come to a middle someplace through a negotiated process.
So then what's your solution that's better than the current way of getting developers to pay for affordable housing?
So in order to really offset that imbalance in the supply and demand, the city has to go head on with building public housing or supporting nonprofit-based housing solutions. Public housing is not some people might have an image of in their minds, because when you say public housing, all of a sudden people develop this image about the slums or the projects of old. It doesn't have to be that way. Public housing just means housing owned by the public. We could build really nice places, you know, the Yesler Terrace thing, for instance. We sold off property, public property, to Vulcan in order for Vulcan to develop that, and for a guarantee of something like 500 affordable units to replace the ones that they're demolishing.
Well, I need to ask you about where we'd get the money to pay for that, because on Facebook, Natalie says, Seattle can't seem to manage its own money. Revenue at an all-time high, and we keep getting asked for more. Would we be asked for more tax money to pay for public housing? And if so, who pays?
No, and I totally agree with that. We need accountability and transparency in the money that we're already getting, you know, before we go to the voters again for more revenue. What I'm proposing is a very creative solution, that a strategy that's used internationally for infrastructure development, but not used in the U.S. except for one exception in North Dakota, and that is to create a publicly owned municipal bank. Through this banking strategy, it'll do a couple of things. It benefits us on the revenue side because it's a bank. It'll make money with the taxpayers' dollars without raising taxes. That's a beautiful thing. But it will also drastically increase our financing capacity because it will leverage the core capital within the bank. I don't want to start sounding too wacky, but
You talk to me about recapitalization all day. Actually, though, speaking of which, what if
glazing over already?
Well, what if we're in a housing bubble? I think all of us remember what happened when the banks struggled and flailed, and we paid. I mean, do we want to get into the publicly owned bank business?
No, the banks would flail. This would actually protect us from those problems that the other banks were into, because they got so over-leveraged that even a little pinprick in that bubble collapsed their system out there. The Bank of North Dakota, which is the model that I'm trying to emulate, actually just last year reported its 13th consecutive year of record profits for the people of North Dakota. So that means it was during that banking bubble that you just referred to, it was making record profits. Mm. So it has the ability to stabilize revenues throughout these economic cycles.
Okay, well, if we fear that it's too wonky, listeners can go to your campaign website or many other places online and learn about municipal-owned banks and the Bank of North Dakota.
Even better than that, though, we're doing a public forum on it this coming Saturday at the University of Washington, Kane Hall, from 7 to 9 p.m., where we have public banking experts coming in to talk about it.
That sinks in more than a website. So Kane Hall this weekend. I'm talking with Washington State Senator Bob Hasegawa, who is a candidate for mayor right now. And before we leave taxes, we talked about Natalie saying we're overtaxed, and you kind of agreed. Yakov says Seattle's biggest problem is the rising cost of living and the gap between the rich and poor. The best way to address this is to tax the rich. Do you support the income tax?
I do support that. I agree with Mr. Yakov.
And what if the income tax is not upheld by the courts and Seattle can't do it? Then what?
Yeah, well, I think it was passed because it's a test, a constitutional test.
Yeah.
Whether we can implement it or not just depends on the Supreme Court. My skepticism, though, comes from the fact that there is a statute that may bar it from even getting to the Supreme Court. And
right.
They change the statute first.
The state law.
And we haven't gotten to that point.
Yeah.
However, the strategy that they're using to get around that statutory bar may hold water. We'll have to see if the Supreme Court can decide whether or not which section of the code actually controls. Is it the section that says cities can control taxation within their own limits, or is it the other section of the code that says they can't implement income tax?
Oh, statutes and codes.
Yeah, sorry.
It's okay.
Your eyes are glazing over again.
No. It takes a lot. I'm interested. I would like to circle back, though, to something you told me at the very beginning when we first started talking. You said, I'm a lifelong Seattleite, third generation, a lifelong Beacon Hill resident, right?
Yes, sir.
So how do you, let's talk about changing Seattle. How do you feel when you see Beacon Hill's new construction and new people and richer people and the new handmade pita restaurant and all those changes? Was Seattle better before the newcomers?
I wouldn't say better. It was just different. I do miss the fact that kids don't play in the streets anymore. You know,
why don't they play in the streets?
Well, the social attitudes have just changed. We've moved on from then. You know, I think about the days when, you know, my dad, should I admit this, he was a smoker. He just sent me with a few bucks to walk two blocks to the corner grocery store and buy him a pack of cigarettes and walk it home to him, right?
Uh-huh.
And we'd play kickball out in the intersection using the manhole cover as a home base and, you know, that kind of stuff. And number one, there aren't that many kids in the neighborhood anymore, but I get the sense that parents are so protective of their kids now, more so than they were back then. My parents would send me, I think I was maybe 10 years old or so, they'd send me on the bus by myself to ride down to the YMCA downtown to take swimming lessons.
Yeah.
And the bus driver would look after us. And I remember the bus driver just letting me play with the door opener switch. I thought that was so cool. And he kind of explained to me how it worked. And, you know, it was more a sense of community back then.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Community and you got an exploration when you were a
yeah.
little kid.
Yeah.
Well, that's a conversation we have all across America. Do you think in Seattle that our cult, have we lost a great Seattle culture and are we lesser for it?
I think we are losing it very quickly through the displacement that's happening. You know, in Beacon Hill, for instance, that was one of those informally redlined areas where people of color, families of color, were only allowed to buy in. That's why there was, back in the day, so many families of color up there. But increasingly now, those families, the people that moved into there and bought those houses originally, their children can't afford to live in the city, and those that are remaining are on fixed incomes. And so as we continue to increase property taxes on them, they're less and less able to afford to stay in their own homes. So they're having to sell. You know, I was just at a Beacon Hill festival a few weeks ago, and one of the leaders said they can't count how many People have come up to them and told them they have to move out of Seattle because their house was torn down and replaced with development.
Oh, there's so many questions I could ask about that. I mean, for one thing, you brought up race, and I wonder, you know, when Ed Murray became mayor, people said, of course, a gay-friendly city like Seattle would have an openly gay mayor. It fits us. But why do you think Seattle's never had an Asian-American mayor? I don't think we have, right?
Nope.
And that would certainly fit us. Do you have any opinion about that?
Yeah, well, Seattle is down to, I think, 20% of the registered voters are people of color. So it's hard to leverage. You know, you have to appeal to social conscience and justice. And I don't run on the fact that I would be the first Asian. I'm running on the issues. And I'm hoping that a lot of my issues, which actually are old strategies that we've gotten away from. We've gotten away from democracy, pretty much. Our city government has reverted from a government of, by, and for the people to a top-down model. It's like government of, by, and for the people with the most money anymore. So decisions are being made from the top and implemented onto the neighborhoods, and everybody, this is a common theme I hear throughout the city, is that nobody feels like they've ever been consulted on any of the major decisions, or if they were asked their opinion, that it was not given any consideration whatsoever. So that's fundamentally a change that has to happen before we can move forward on dealing with a lot of these neighborhood issues and the displacement that's going on.
Well, speaking of displacement, Seattle's new navigation center opened this week, 24-hour shelter with social services. Would you do anything differently about homelessness from what Mayor Murray is doing now, or would you stay the course?
Well, that navigation center is a huge issue in Little Saigon because we can't even get to talking about the merits of a navigation center, which there are good things about it, because of the process that was followed or not followed in citing that thing. That there again, it underscores my previous point about top-down government. The decision was made, they're just going to put that in the heart of Little Saigon in the International District, and that was done. So when the community riled up and rallied against it, the mayor put a temporary hold on the opening and said he would consider the community's input at that point. So the community went through this whole process of trying to hold a series of hearings and get feedback from the neighborhood and the people that live there. And then halfway through that process, they were developing their list of issues that the city needs to address. And then the mayor said, never mind, we're going to just open it.
Well, what if the mayor had done more asking for input, and then the input from Little Saigon neighborhood had been, no, we don't want it. Well, now where is it going to go?
That was someplace where they were at. They were at the point saying, so we know the decision is made to cite it here.
Right.
So we will just ask for what are the conditions that we're most concerned about affecting our neighborhoods. And they never got to finish that process. They had accepted the fact that it would be cited there. So to me, it was just totally disrespectful of the community itself.
Did you think that had an economic tinge to it, a racial and ethnicity, or just is this just about government top down?
I'm not going to assign motives on why it happened the way it did.
Okay. Washington State Senator Bob Hasegawa, running for mayor of Seattle. We're running out of time, and I know one thing I haven't asked you about was I learned that you're apparently a big vaping guy. This event the other night.
You don't mind me whacking it out right now?
Yeah, you brought it, huh?
I got.
What's the big thing about vaping with you?
So I used to smoke Swisher Sweets, I'll admit.
Uh-huh.
And so I was up to about a pack of those, which contains five of them a day.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's not so cool when you have to sit close to people, especially in the legislature. Uh-huh. So I switched to vaping because it's better for you. And for over 2 years now, 2 years from May, I have not had a stogie. Except when I was a delegate to the Democratic National Convention, they would not allow us to bring a vape in, so I had to smoke stogies.
You had to smoke a stogie.
I just had to do it. I'm sorry.
Did it taste wonderful again, or did it?
No, it
I just
horrible.
Want my cherry bubble.
No, it
vaping.
It tasted horrible, but
okay. Yeah. Favorite flavor, cherry bubble. What's better, puckerberry, cherry, like, cosmic fog?
I like mango tango.
Mango tango. Yeah. No, I pegged you for a mango tango guy. Washington State Senator Bob Hasegawa. Before we go, anything that you want to say? Because I've been just asking all the questions.
No, I've been throughout the city, and people are such good hearts, you know, and I'm really appreciate this opportunity to just be able to speak with everybody. It's wonderful.
Well, good luck in the legislature, if that's what it is, but good luck at the helm of the city of Seattle if you're the next mayor. Well, thanks again.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate that.
Primary ballots due August 1st. Welcome to the studio, and great to meet you.
It's a pleasure being here. Thanks, Bill.
KUOW's The Record, back in a moment with the love story. It's KOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Now we're going to talk about romantic love. And what's more important than that? Love is in all of our movies and songs and TV shows. We crave love. We move across the country for love. Love is very often how our children happen. Love is a big deal. And yet, listen to how we talk about it. You fall in love. You're so helpless. You're falling. You're swooning, and love makes you crazy. Yes, Beyonce, love is madness. It's achy breaky. Well, my next guest has been studying how we talk about love and think about it and what love is biologically, and she has a less crazy, less achy breaky way to think about love. Mandy Len Catron, welcome to KOW.
Thank you.
Your new book is called How to Fall in Love with Anyone, and I already knew you from that New York Times piece that went bananas online. How many people have read that? Do you know?
I don't know, like a lot. So I think in the first month it had 8 million views, and yeah. Since then it seems to be consistently super high. I just talked to the Modern Love editor last week, and he was saying like people still read it all the time.
Has to be top, I don't know, top five, top three?
It was top five in 2015.
In 2015.
Yeah, it was number four.
You broke the New York Times. Congratulations. In case you haven't read it, we'll tweet it out right now.
Yeah.
At KUOW. And by the way, you can join us on Twitter. You can also call in, because I have so many questions for you, Mandy, but then we also have listeners who might have questions. Our phone number is 206-543-5869. 206-543-5869. So let's make sure everybody knows what we're talking about. If you read the New York Times piece, people who read it know that you experimented with the 36 questions, and we'll get to those questions in you staring into his eyes.
Okay.
I promise. But first, let's just establish the problem, if it is. Why is it a problem how we think about love as this thing we fall helplessly into?
Well, I mean, it's kind of like you were just saying, like people move across the country for love. So what I think is really interesting is that we're so intentional about so many parts of our lives, the kind of job we want, the kind of career we want to have, how many children. But for whatever reason, I mean, I have a lot of theories about why this is,
mm-hmm.
but we want love to just be mystical. We want to turn this major decision over to what we imagine is fate or destiny or some sort of larger forces that are acting on us. And if you think about it, that seems kind of crazy.
Why do we seem to want love to be something we're helpless and crazy and about? We swoon and get smitten and fall.
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing is, love is a biological experience, and it activates the reward system of our brains. And so I think it feels so good and so profound and so important that we like to imagine that that also means that it's unknowable, that it's something we can't possibly dissect, or we would ruin it.
Uh-huh.
But what I've found is that actually I really enjoyed dissecting it,
uh-huh.
and that it hasn't ruined the experience of actually being in love for me at all.
Yeah, you demystified it for yourself.
Yeah.
Can I give one more possibility before we move on? Because it sounded like you were talking about God, the way you, right? The way you were saying we want somebody to be mystical and unknowable and sort of perfect, but yet terrible, right? And that's how we talk about God. Is that a coincidence? When I say terrible, I mean terrible justice like, and awesome. Smiting you.
Yeah. I mean, we use the word smitten.
Smitten.
About being in love.
That
right?
means so, smiting. Yeah.
Which I think is really interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe it's not a coincidence. I think in general, we like the idea that, there are some aspects of our experience that are really sort of beyond human comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we want love to be one of those things. But the reality is scientists are increasingly understanding love from a bunch of different disciplines. And we are learning more about it. And I feel like we might as well use that knowledge to our benefit.
Yeah. Okay. Let's demystify and learn together. Again, this is Mandy Lynn Catron, How to Fall in Love with Anyone, and our phone number. You can ask her a question or tell your own love story, which may refute what she's saying, or you may think, yes, that my love story is unusual in just that way. 206-543-5869. That's 543-KUOW. So you went looking for a demystified, better, I think, more useful way of thinking about love. So let's talk about those 36 questions. What is the story behind the 36 questions that you wrote about in the New York Times?
Yeah, so basically in the process of doing this research, I came across the study that psychologist Arthur Aaron had designed to try and create romantic love in the laboratory. And the way it works is two people, strangers in the initial study, take turns asking each other 36 increasingly personal questions. And then they stare into each other's eyes for 4 minutes without speaking. And I thought that was pretty interesting, but I was fairly skeptical. And I just sort of filed it away in my mind with all the other research I had done. And then I was on a date a couple years later with an acquaintance, and he said, I have this theory that you could fall in love with anyone. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. I wonder if that's true. And so I told him about the study because it sort of made me remember it. And I said, you know, I've always wanted to try it. And he said, let's do it. And so we did. And I wrote about it.
How did you feel about this person up to this point?
You know, I thought he was kind of cute. Like I was interested, but I didn't know him very well at all. So obviously our experience was not the same as doing it in a lab. We were doing it in a bar.
Yes.
And obviously no one suggests doing that or agrees to go along with it if you aren't a little bit open to the possibility of falling in love.
So it's a bit of a cheat because you're already interested enough to be doing it.
Exactly. Yeah.
But why would this scientist, was a psychologist?
Yeah.
Why would he want to create love in a laboratory? What's the point?
I don't know. I think maybe just out of curiosity.
Okay.
The thing is this particular initial study was never formally published, but it is referenced in several other studies. And he's gone on to use the questions in lots of contexts that have nothing to do with romantic love.
Hmm.
And what he's found is that, like, he's used it between police officers and members of a community or people from different ethnic groups.
Maybe we should pause and tell people some of the questions so they can get an idea of what we're talking about. Because some of them are kind of standard book of question icebreakers, like who's your ideal dinner guest?
Yeah.
But then it starts to turn. And there's like, there are non-questions, like if you were going to become a close friend with your partner, what would be important for, well, that's a question for him or her to know.
Yeah.
But then tell your partner what you like about them. Be very honest this time, saying things that you might not say to someone you've just met. And then we are both in this room feeling fill in the blank.
Yeah.
So those aren't just questions. What's this psychologist going after?
So what they call it is sustained escalating reciprocal personal self-disclosure.
Sustained escalating personal reciprocal self-disclosure.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. So the idea is that you do it over a sort of concentrated period of time and that you have to take turns doing it and that it becomes increasingly intimate over time. And I think the goal is just to take the process of developing a close relationship that might take weeks or even months and just accelerate that into a few hours.
Why would we want to do that?
Because it feels good to be known, I think.
Mm-hmm.
This is my theory.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exciting to get to know someone else.
It feels a little demystifying because we think we're such complex works of art.
Yeah.
And then it seems like what we're actually finding out is, look, if you just take the time to stare into each other's eyes for 4 minutes, we're not that different. And these questions involve really caring enough about and talking about what you like about the person and sharing.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you can do stuff instead of just, hope you find your
for the best,
your soulmate.
Wait. Yeah. Which I think is really empowering.
So how did it go with this guy?
And so it went really well. Basically, my feeling the next morning was like, maybe we'll be close friends or maybe we'll start a romantic relationship. And I kind of just thought, it doesn't matter. Like, I'm just really glad to know him, which is so different from my experiences with online dating where I just felt so much anxiety and confusion. But then we did start dating 3 months later.
Did you have a much different feeling about him after the 36 questions and the 4 minute staring? What changed?
Yeah, I think I suspected that he was a good guy before and after. I felt like I really knew and I really trusted him, which was nice. And I think I wasn't great at trusting people that I didn't know very well.
Okay, but here's my question. You found out in those questions and the staring that he's a good guy.
Yeah.
But could you just as easily have found out, oh, he's a bad guy, or I can't stand this kind of guy? Or are you saying, no, we're not, as I said, we're not that different. If you lean into these 36 questions and do the staring, you will probably find out that's a good person.
Yeah, I mean, I think in many cases that is what happens, is that you sort of have to like affirm and reveal your like underlying human vulnerability in this process. I've heard from a few people who did it with someone who became like increasingly closed throughout the process and became more uncomfortable, which maybe then is a good suggestion that like this isn't someone that would be easy to have a relationship with.
Right. Again, I'm talking with Mandy Lynn Catron. The book is How to Fall in Love with Anyone. 206-543-5869. 206-543-KUOW. Is that title, it's very marketable. Is that really how you feel? How to Fall in Love with Anyone?
I did not title the book.
Uh-huh.
But I do think the reality is, the reality is that we can be open to love and love's possibilities in a lot of ways that we just don't acknowledge in our culture.
Yeah, well, then let's get to that, because we started with what the culture says about love up to now, and you went after a better metaphor, a better way of thinking about love.
Yeah.
What's that?
Well, I mean, I tried to think about it in a lot of different ways. One of the, if you want to think in terms of the language, as you were saying, like smitten, crushed, all of these things really suggest that it's something that happens to us. I came across a couple of linguists who wrote this paper called Metaphors We Live By, who essentially suggest that metaphors really do control how we experience the world.
George Lakoff, right?
Yes, and Mark Johnson. Uh-huh. And one of the things that they suggested was that you could make a new metaphor. And the metaphor they offer is love is a collaborative work of art, which I really like and try to use in my own relationships. And not
Let's just, say that again. Love is a collaborative work of art.
Yeah.
Why is that important?
So if you think about, they call it entailments, all the ideas contained in this metaphor. So it suggests that love is creative. Love is something two people do actively together, or maybe even more than two people. Love is something that is meaningful and beautiful. It also suggests that all different kinds of love can be valuable. Like, it doesn't have to be a specific experience of love.
Like, it's the lifelong monogamy doesn't have to be, yeah.
Okay. That's not the only way to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
If we're going to be honest about what love could be, if you try to stuff it into this one way, that's a problem.
Yeah. Which I think most of our sort of cultural ideology or our stories about love kind of do. They really channel it into long-term monogamous commitment.
Yeah. I think I'm quoting you that you said a possible way to think of it was, oh, you know, that relationship was beautiful and shorter than I had planned.
Yeah.
As opposed to a bust and a tragedy.
Yeah. So often I think we think about the end of a relationship as a failure, but it doesn't have to be conceptualized that way.
Right. So again, Mandy Lynn Catron, How to Fall in Love with Anyone. So, okay, how are we going to get this different metaphor into popular culture?
You know, that's a really good question. And I think one way to just sort of in general expand how we think about romantic love is to actually be more thoughtful about the kinds of love stories that we make, if you tell stories or create stories, and that we consume, if we're just like seeking them out. So throughout the process of writing this book, I really made an effort to find more diverse kinds of love stories. So that meant everything from like stories about queer love to stories about non-monogamous love to stories about short relationships or to stories about people who'd been married a long time and were trying to deal with like midlife. And what I found was they really expanded my sense of what was possible in love and how I might practice it. And I really think that's so valuable, which is, so there's a theory that basically stories provide us with scripts for how we might live our lives. And so the more scripts we have, the more possible it is for any individual to make love what they want in their life. And I think that's a pretty exciting idea.
You know, I have preached for a long time what your friend and, I don't know, are you still together with this guy?
I am.
Okay. Yeah. That you can kind of fall in love with anyone. And one way of thinking about it is, I basically decided to fall in love with my kids, even though I hadn't met them yet. And as it turns out, they're not especially deserving of love. You know, they're just people.
They're just people.
But that's a different way of looking at love than, oh, I hope my kids happen to be my soulmate, which is how we try to do it when it's adult romantic love.
I love this idea.
Yeah?
That's great. Yeah.
There's your sequel.
There's your sequel.
I don't know the title yet, but it's going to be about deciding to love kids who don't especially deserve it. I may have just traumatized my children right there. But that's how I feel. Well, okay, I got so into talking with you, and we have other things that we're going to do this hour. But I just thank you for this conversation. And, and that, I remember reading that article, whatever it was, 2 years ago. When was it?
Yeah, January 2015.
I'm sure I shared it, and it's just interesting stuff and a worthy book. It's called How to Fall in Love with Anyone. Mandy Len Catron, Vancouver, BC resident.
That's right.
Headed back home.
Headed home tomorrow.
Good to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
Come
back. You're not far away. Come back sometime.
I would love to.
Talk about your sequel that I inspired, and I will get a cut of that.
No problem.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. This is The Record. Glad to have you here. Earlier this hour, we were talking about homelessness in Seattle with mayoral candidate Bob Hasegawa. Of course, you'll find people in every city in the Puget Sound area who don't have a place to live. The rents are rising in Bremerton. People are being forced into the streets. And the city of Bremerton admits it didn't really see this crisis coming, as KUOW's Carolyn Adolph reports.
Linda Johnson has three children, and this is her car. It's a four-door sedan with diapers stashed in the back.
And like you can see where you're sitting, there's not much room. That car seat has to stay there, so the 14-year-old, where she's sleeping, we have to make room back here, rotate things just to be able to sleep in here. It's not fun.
Until a few months ago, Linda Johnson was living with her two children in an apartment. She works a low-wage job, but that wasn't enough after her third child was born. The landlord did some repairs and raised the rent from $750 a month to $1,000. Johnson and her family were out with no place to go.
Packing up my children, figuring out where we're going to be sleeping, showering. I have to be presentable. I manage a restaurant. I can't be there without a shower.
Rents are low in Bremerton compared to just about anywhere else in the region. But wages are also low.
We have low rent, low income, and a vulnerable population.
This is Patty Lent, mayor of Bremerton.
Outside people or people that want to invest are buying up apartment houses that used to be low income. They're remodeling them, and they're raising that price. So those people now are without homes.
And agencies are struggling to place them. Shelters were full when Linda Johnson lost her apartment. She had an infant, so agencies found the cash to put her in a hotel. It ran out, and the shelters were still full. So the family turned to sleeping in the car.
So you slept sitting up?
Yeah, sometimes. We've done it a little bit of all ways. Flip this seat forward, try to make room back there for all three of us, or four of us at that point.
The hardest thing is when you have someone that's working with children and they're doing everything they can to get out of the situation that they're in. And yet, in many cases, there's no place to go.
This is Monica Bernard, Director of Housing for Kitsap Community Resources. Her organization now has Linda Johnson living in a shelter.
You know, it's just not an uncommon situation to have, you know, fathers of children, families with children, mothers with young children. And they're living in tents, they're living in cars because the shelters are full.
Or because they have a history that gives landlords a reason to refuse them. eviction, or credit issues, or brushes with the law.
Maybe they just simply don't have enough income. Landlords today often require a household to be making 2 to 3 times the rent.
For people on minimum wage, Monica Bernard says that's difficult.
And with rising rents, that's almost impossible.
Rents are up because developers have been prepping Bremerton to become a new bedroom community for Seattle. With the city's blessing.
Did you understand when you were being successful in having developers come in that there would be displacement?
I don't think that I gave enough attention to caution.
This is Bremerton Mayor Patty Lent.
I didn't have a plan B. I see that we didn't prepare to prevent that.
Lent says there are empty houses that could be fixed up for low-income families. The county does offer a protected place where people can sleep in their cars. There's also talk of building tiny houses and of a housing levy to expand the supply of affordable housing. None of these ideas will help Linda Johnson find an apartment soon.
You get 90 days in the state of Washington in an emergency shelter. So then what?
This is Cheryl Piercy, Social Services Director at the Bremerton Corp of the Salvation Army. She knows the situation for Linda Johnson.
What would she do? I mean, she'd be in her car with a 4-month-old this winter.
Linda Johnson says she will stay focused on finding a solution.
I'm getting through, and we're going to do this. We will get a house, and everything happens for a reason.
She hopes it will be soon. In Bremerton, I'm Carolyn Adolph, KUOW News.
In Bremerton, if your car is parked on the street, you can only leave it for 72 hours. And that's the same in Seattle. Now, these laws might not be written to target homeless people, but they can end up in a web of laws that some people say criminalize homelessness. So says Seattle University law professor Sarah Rankin, founder and director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
And also on the line with us so we can discuss this from a couple different points of view, Harley Lever is the founder of Safe Seattle, also a candidate for Seattle mayor. Harley, welcome back to KUOW.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Bill.
So first of all, Professor Rankin, I quoted you as talking about laws that criminalize homelessness. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a variety of laws. It's sort of a matrix of laws and policies that are in place that affect not only vehicle residents, and I can talk specifically about some types of laws that disproportionately and especially penalize vehicle residents. But overall, criminalization laws are laws that prohibit or severely restrict one's ability to engage in necessary life-sustaining activities in public.
What's an example?
An example would be laws that affect one's ability to sit, stand, sleep, receive food, ask for help, protect oneself from the elements. These are all things that none of us could forego for very long and still survive. And yet the act of surviving in public is very tightly regulated and has this disproportionate impact on people experiencing homelessness.
And can you explain how we go from not wanting, what politician in the Puget Sound area says, I want to criminalize homelessness, but how we go from a presumably good intention to an outcome you don't like?
Well, you know, there's a lot of, I've written a lot about some of the sociological and cognitive reasons why we tend to identify visible poverty as something that we don't want to see, and how we codify those sorts of fears and concerns and impulses in our laws. But you're right, people don't craft these laws with the intention of having a disproportionate impact on homelessness. That's why it's so important that people understand that that's the way that they function in practice. And it's also important to understand that if somebody's caught violating one of these laws, it may result in a misdemeanor. That misdemeanor, if you are saddled with a misdemeanor, that can therefore impact your ability to access shelter, food, benefits, and other services that are designed to lift you out of homelessness. And even laws that don't start as misdemeanors can actually evolve into misdemeanors over time.
So there's that web. I used the word web earlier. You're trapped in a web.
That's right.
Also on the line with us, as I said, Harley Lever is the founder of Safe Seattle. And Harley, you say that if there are services in place, and you say Seattle does have a long way to go there, but if there are services in place, you like a carrot and stick approach. What does that look like?
Yes, so Boston's actually a really good model in that they have robust homeless services. They only have 160 people that live outside, and you know they offer services, asking them to take services immediately. We have a large service-resistant homeless population in Seattle. Part of it's due because our shelter systems are not up to par, but sometimes people just don't want to live by societal rules. There's addiction issues in that, and so the carrot and stick approach would say, hey, we love you, we want to help you, can you please accept addiction services, homeless services, job services? If you don't, you have that right not to, but we're asking you to accept services, and please do so.
But Harley, do you accept Professor Rankin's portrait here that laws that make it virtually impossible to, as she said, to sit, to stand, to be in your car, and then that trap you with misdemeanors that cause further problems, do you agree that there is an effect, not an intention maybe, but an effect of criminalizing homelessness?
Yeah, I think that is, we need a much more intelligent approach to our justice system. That shouldn't be the case. You shouldn't be have a misdemeanor. What you should have is services. But we also have to recognize that we have an opiate addiction problem where we have a lot of people that are committing crimes on a regular basis that are hiding that are homeless, and so it's a far more complicated issue than saying black and white. We really need to have a nuanced approach and look at every single case, as a distinct case, and not just say, these poor people are being criminalized. In some cases, that is the case, but we should be have a more nuanced approach to that. And so, just allowing camping is not the answer. And we see that a lot of these encampments devolve into really bad crime scenes. We have people that are...
Harley Lever? Gotcha.
Yes.
I can hear you again. I lost you for a moment.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm saying we have a lot of people that are being sex trafficked out of these encampments. We have a lot of people that are being murdered and assaulted. Drug lords in these encampments that are abusing people who are addicted to opiates. And so we have to really take a nuanced approach and recognize what's going on.
Before I turn to Professor Rankin, Harley, do I understand it right that you have personal experience of a family member who's addicted? Is that something you want to talk about, share with us?
Sure, absolutely. My brother is a homeless heroin addict in Boston. Last year, he overdosed 4 times. What heroin does is it turns everything you know about love on its head, because you think if you provide money, if you provide a bed, if you provide gifts, that you're helping. But really what happens is, he will sell his gifts for heroin. He will take that money and buy heroin with it. And so we're actually, every time we try to help him in that way, we actually endanger him because he will go and purchase heroin with it.
Professor Rankin, you've heard the idea of a carrot and stick approach and, a tough love approach, and sometimes giving people what they want isn't what's helpful to them. How do you reflect on that, given that you're concerned about a web of laws that criminalize homelessness?
Well, I think as a preliminary matter, we really need to be careful that whenever we talk about homelessness, we don't slip into a conversation where we're painting entire communities as criminal. There are a lot of law-abiding people who are experiencing homelessness, and to the extent that they're violating any particular laws, they're the sort of laws that they can't help but violate some of the criminalization laws that I mentioned before. So that's the first caution. I would really put the brakes on conversations where we start diving into deeper dives on substance abuse, because that is a cause and consequence of some people experiencing homelessness. But it's certainly not fair to address the whole community of people experiencing homelessness through a lens that paints them as tending to be criminal or tending to flout laws. There's plenty of law-abiding people who are facing this horrible condition and circumstance. The other thing that I would say is I agree with Harvey that there needs to be a more nuanced approach, but I disagree that the approach should be to condition services or shelter or anything on acceptance of services. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is it flies in the face of a whole host of studies that have shown that the best approach is to provide people with housing first. There's a program actually called Housing First, and plenty of studies that have been done to show that instead of forcing people to comply with all sorts of different rules and then providing them with housing, the outcomes are actually better and cheaper if you first provide them with housing and then allow them to start taking advantage of services after they've experienced that sort of stability that is necessary for them to start putting their lives back together. So your listeners can look at some of those many studies that have been done on housing. And the other is the other important distinction is that we have taught many people to distrust offers of services and shelter. And there's many reasons for that. One is we've got far fewer beds than there are people who need them. The other is we don't have a clear and reliable method for finding any open beds that might exist and notifying people about them and then getting them to those places.
Correct.
And there's a whole gauntlet of obstacles that really functionally keep a good portion of the homeless population from being able to successfully access shelter and services.
I want to give the last word to Harley Lever because we just have 1 minute left. Harley, any reaction to that as we're discussing criminalizing homelessness versus a sort of a tough love or carrot and stick approach?
I agree wholeheartedly with the Housing First model, and that is something I promote actively both on Safe Seattle and as part of my campaign. I would make the distinction that Seattle has the problem of not getting homeless people into housing. We have a very dysfunctional system that is antiquated. We literally use 1980s technology of, we call around and ask people if they have a shelter system versus having an online dashboard that lists all the vacancies and all the available services. So first responders like police officers, fire departments, social workers have access to this information. They can provide it to their clients. So,
Harley, I've got to pause it there. We're literally out of time. Harley Lever, Safe Seattle, and candidate for Seattle mayor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Seattle University Law Professor Sarah Rankin from the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. Thanks for this conversation.
My pleasure.
And thank you for listening. Love to hear your response on Twitter @KUOW. We appreciate your listening today.